Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It is a perfect cocktail that's being stirred up. We've got the incompetent Fed, that's the monetary side, and the general policy side. There's a lot of protectionist talk and action in the wind. You can't pick up the paper without seeing something about attacking China, for example. Secretary Yellen was just in China, and she said that, well, they're suffering from overcapacity. Now, what in the world's overcapacity?
Hi, and welcome to Wealthion. My name is James Conner, and today my guest is Professor Steve Henke. And Steve is a professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins University. Steve has done much research on the money supply and its impact on inflation and also economic growth. And so we're going to get Steve's views on where he thinks we are in the economy and if and when we're going to go into recession. Hi, Steve. Thank you very much for joining us today. How are things in Baltimore?
Things are great down here, James. Good to be with you.
And are you still teaching? Are things still very active at the university?
Yeah, things are active, but with me, they're always active. I mean, it's more or less 24/7, 12 months out of the year. So the year changes very little for me, except during the summer months. Obviously, there aren't as many people around, but that's about the only difference.
And you're leading a big research team, too. How many students on your research team?
I've got 31.
So that keeps you busy.
I've got a lot of good assistants. Some of them are a little greener than others, so you got to watch them carefully.
So I want to get your views on the economy, and I want to first start with the money supply. And you and your partner, John Greenwood, have done much research on the money supply and also the quantity theory of money. And I want to start right here. And it's been a while since I took an economics class. So let's just start with the basics. What exactly is the money supply and how do we measure it?
Well, the money supply, at least in the United States, the broadest measure of money is what they call M2. And M2 is made up of the following components, James. Currency is one thing, notes and coins. That's what most people think money is. But that only makes up about 11% of broad money. 76% is made up by liquid deposits in banks, like your checking account. Your checking account is money. You write a check and it's good for a transaction, assuming you're a reliable client, have something in the bank. But in general, those deposits at banks are included, and that's about 76% of the money supply, and about 5% are small time deposits at banks. And about 8% are money market accounts, so retail money market accounts. So the big elephant in the room are deposits, liquid deposits in the banking system, and most people don't realize that I call that bank money, and bank money is credit is issued by banks, and once a bank makes a loan to you, your checking account is topped up, and bingo, that's money. So banks produce, in fact, most of the money, commercial banks, and always have been. So if you look in most countries, about 80 to 90% of the money supply, broadly measured, is made up of bank money. The remaining part is made up of what I call state money, and that's what comes from the central banks. That's notes and coins. So there you have it. That is the definition in the United States, and other countries have slightly different configurations of these broad monies with other components in it, but they'll all have the bulk of, will be these commercial bank deposits. So in that sense, most people don't have a very good idea of what money actually is, because they just think it's notes and coins. But in fact, notes and coins, as I noted, are fairly small potatoes in the picture. So that is the money supply. And when the money supply moves around, the economy moves around. And if you get substantial changes in the money supply, you get, first of all, there's a transmission mechanism. It takes time for these changes to go through the economy and have an effect. And as you increase the money supply, let's just do the increase side of it, which we will talk about that starting really with the pandemic, COVID in early 2020. And when that started, the U.S. Central Bank and loosened the monetary rein, shall we say, and the money supply started increasing. And with a lag of about 1 to 9 months, then you get asset prices start increasing. And sure enough, we had a big boom in the stock market and real estate market. All hard assets went up tremendously in value. In the United States, the S&P 500, that's the equity market, from March of 2020 until January of 2022, it increased by 114%. That's equity assets. Now, if you look at farmland, for example, prime farmland in Iowa, 2020 to start of 2022, up a little over 30%. Residential home prices in the U.S. in that same period of time, up a little over 44%. So that's the first phase, this 1 to 9 month surge. And then with a little longer lag, 6 to 18 months, the economy starts revving up after you've had a big increase in the money supply. And in the United States, in the average for the 2021-22 period after the goosing of the money supply, the average real rate of growth in the economy is 4.1%. Now, that's higher than the potential sustainable growth rate in the United States, about 2.2%. So it was about double, actually. And then ultimately, of course, we had a lot of inflation with a lag after the increase in the money supply or the fuel in the economy, about 12 to 24 month lag. And you mentioned John Greenwood and myself and our work with the quantity theory of money, and that the quantity theory of money in simple terms is just, it's the money supply, stupid. The changes in the money supply are going to change asset prices, economic activity, inflation. These things follow changes in the money supply. And we anticipated the inflation in the United States, and we said that we thought it could go up to as high as 9%. And in June of 2022, it actually peaked out at 9.1%. So we hit the bullseye with the inflation forecast on the upside. And then we've started a downside. Money supply has been coming down and contracting in the United States. And now it's contracting on a year-over-year basis. It's about 2% year-over-year contraction. And since March of 2022, we have had actually a decline of about 3.2%. So it's been contracting. So when we went up, by the way, just to give you an idea of how fast it went up, by February of 2021, that's when it peaked out, this M2 measure, and it peaked out at 27% per year. And that's way higher than what I call Hanke's golden growth rate. And That's a 6% rate that would be consistent, given the quantity theory of money, of hitting an inflation target of 2%. If you want to hit 2%, the money supply should be growing at a constant 6% growth rate year over year. Well, it went up to 27%. That's the highest it's ever been recorded in the United States. So it was an extraordinary event. And now this contraction thing that I'm talking about, that's almost unprecedented. We've only had four times where the money supply has actually contracted in the United States since the Fed, the central bank, was established in 1913. One of those was 1920, 21. Another one was 29, 33. Another one was 37, 38. And another one was 48, 49. And what happened after each one of those contractions? We had a recession. And that's why I think we will be seeing eventually a recession in the United States late this year or early next year. And that's why also I think the inflation rate, it has come down, but it's kind of plateaued out the last 3 months. It's now running 3.5%, but I think it will continue to come down with this monetary contraction. So that's more or less the picture. Big change in the money supply, and you've got this transmission mechanism with these lags, asset prices moving, then the economy moving, and then inflation moving. That's the way it works.
So just to summarize, money and the components of the money supply are the fuel to drive the economy. The more money in the system, the stronger the economy. And conversely, the less money in the system, the weaker the economy is.
You got it. And in fact, there's never been, in the world, by the way, there's never been a case in which you've had sustained inflation over 4%. Where you haven't had a big increase in the money supply prior to the inflation running over 4%. And I've looked, by the way, I did a study that was published last September in World Economics, in which I looked at 147 countries. And I looked at these countries from 1990 to 2021, and I looked at the change in the money supply and the change in inflation, and you really had kind of a proportionality there. You have a correlation. It was almost 1-to-1. It was 0.94 between changes in the money supply and changes in inflation. You more or less had a 1-to-1 relationship. Change the money supply by 10%, you're going to get a 10% increase in inflation, and vice versa. If you slow things down, you'll slow inflation down.
And you made mention of the fact that there's only been four other times in history when we've had a contraction in the money supply, and each of these times the economy went into a recession. Do I have that right?
Yep, you got it.
And I'm surprised to hear that the last time it happened was in 1948 and 1949.
Oh, yeah. It's very, very unusual. I mean, shall we say, in the post-World War II era, it's never happened.
And why is that? Because we've had many recessions since that time.
Well, we've had many, many, many recessions, but we've also had many times where the money supply went up and then came down. If it comes down, it might not go negative on you as it is now, a real outright contraction, but it can slow way down. And if it slows down rapidly and it stays below that golden growth rate of 6% per year, you've got a pretty good chance of having a recession on your hands. That's what's going on.
And so let's talk about that recession. The last time we spoke, I believe it was late 2023, you were expecting a recession in 2023. We didn't get it. Now you're saying it's 2024. And I understand there's a lag associated with these things.
Well, the original forecast, just to be clear on this, Greenwood and I thought that it would come earlier than it did. We originally thought it would come in late 2023. Well, we were wrong, and we changed our forecast. Now, why were we wrong, and why did we change our forecast? Because what had happened is that the buildup in excess cash balances, excess money in the system, people had accumulated a tremendous amount of money during the pandemic, much more than they would have desired to be holding in terms of cash. That would be, and the way to get that is to take M2, the money supply, and just divide it by GDP, and that's a cash balance. Well, that's it goes up on a trend as the economy grows and so forth. People demand more cash, so there's a trend increasing the demand for money as M2 is about 1.7% per year. It goes up. Well, with this huge blip, increasing the thing at 27% per year, there was just a massive amount of excess money in the system. And that slowly started draining out, but it didn't drain out as fast as Greenwood and I thought it would. And as a result of that, the economy is kept going and it's been pretty strong. Now all that excess actually has been drained out, and we should be seeing a convergence towards this more normal trend rate of, you know, around 1.7-1.8% growth in the demand for money. And as that occurs, then we will see the slowdown really start biting. So that's why we were off. It was this unusual bulge that we had, and the excess cash balances that had been built up, we thought they would drain off faster than they actually did. And when I say drain off, that people would spend the money. We thought they would spend the money faster than they actually did. And as a result of that, we were way ahead of the game on predicting a recession. We just didn't get it right. And once we saw what was going on, we changed our forecast to move it instead of late 23 to late 24. Now, the interesting part is we've always said the recession is baked in the cake because the money supply has contracted. So that's why the baked in the cake expression comes into the picture. Things that happen in the economy are baked in the cake a long time before they actually happen because of all these lags going on. And remember, these lags are long and variable. They don't happen. They don't come. Inflation doesn't all of a sudden rear its ugly head 24 months after the big change in the money supply. Maybe it can be 12 months. Maybe it could be 36, by the way. Maybe it could be really drug out. They're usually, the lag is between 12 and 24 months between big changes in the money supply and inflation. But it varies all over the place. So you've got to keep your eye on the ball. And what happened once we saw that the contemporary data were changing and the draining, the excess was slower than we had anticipated, we changed our forecast. And, you know, to quote John Maynard Keynes, you know, somebody asked him why he changed his forecast. And he said, when the facts are changed, I change my mind. What do you do, sir?
I like that quote. I might have to use that one. So, and let's talk a little bit about this pending recession, okay? And given that the growth in the money supply was so excessive, 27%, I believe you said, year over year. And then we've had this sharp contraction, once again, in a very short period of time. Do you think this recession is going to be a severe one?
I don't really know. The only thing I know is the direction of things. We had this big slowdown, and, by the way, I said that the money supply has contracted about 3.2% since March of 2022. Let me give you the magnitudes on these other contractions that have occurred. The 1920-22, from the peak to the trough, it was a 9% contraction. So we haven't contracted that much. And then the big whopper was 1929-1933. The contraction was almost 39%. And that's when we had the Great Depression. And then 37-38, the contraction was 2.6%. We had a pretty good recession, actually. It lasted 13 months in 37-38. But the contraction was more or less in the same range as the current contraction, that 37-38 one. And then the one in 48-49 was a milder one. It was only about 1.5%. And the recession was milder too. So we can say something about the duration of the recession, maybe not the depth exactly, but look at the big Great Depression. We had a contraction of, almost 39% in the money supply. And the contraction, the recession, the Great Depression, it lasted 43 months. Whereas the most mild recession we've had associated with that monetary contraction in 1948-49, the duration was only 11 months. And the one comparable to what we're talking about now, we now have contracted 3.2%. We had a 2.6% contraction, peak to trough in 37-38. The duration of that recession was 13 months. So getting these things, the idea that you can precisely say when something's going to happen, and precisely the magnitude, it's really a fool's game. No one can do this. I can give you what reliably you can say something about is the pattern of things. And what's coming is a slowdown. And the slowdown will probably be a recession if it's like every one of these other contractions we've had. It's going to be a recession territory. But if not, it's going to be a pretty big slowdown, at least.
So let's just summarize a few of the points you made. And first of all, I want to look at the current economy. And as you mentioned, it appears to be very strong, growing at 3-4%. The jobless rate continues to be very low, below 4% now for many quarters. Stock market continues to make new highs, or it was up until the last couple of weeks. Now we're seeing some weakness. The housing market, I can't really speak for what's happening in the U.S., but in Canada, it's hanging in there pretty good in spite of the mortgage rates being a lot higher in the last couple of years. But overall, things look pretty good to me. And I know we've had this big contraction in the money supply and there's this big leg coming. But do you think when I look at all of these things, I'm being too complacent?
Yes, because those are current data. So if you look at the current data, those are kind of symptoms of what happened before. And the big thing that happened before that's causing the current data that you see and driving them, it's the money supply. What happened to the money supply? And you've got these long and very highly variable lags in the picture. So I'm just saying that given what I know actually happened in reality, this contraction in the money supply and huge slowdown in the money supply, and the fact that all the excess cash balances have pretty much been drained out of the system, I know what's coming down the track. It just isn't here yet.
And to reiterate something you said earlier, we get changes in the money supply first and then changes in asset prices. And the asset prices are starting to change, albeit slowly, but it's going to come.
Yeah, they are starting to change. And when you look at, for example, the stock market, if we look, remember Nobel laureate, a friend of mine, Robert Shiller at Yale, great professor. He's written a number of, famous books. After all, that's how you win a Nobel Prize. But one of them was Irrational Exuberance. That he wrote that in 2000, and he anticipated the tech bubble that we had. Remember, we had that huge run up in the stock market, and then a crash in 2000, 2001. And he anticipated that thing, and what he looked at, he has something called Shiller's cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratios, CAPE ratio, and now that CAPE ratio is 34.4%, and it's higher than 95% of the readings that we've ever had since 1881. Now, what's that mean? It means stock prices are very high now. The price earnings ratio, the way Shiller measures it, which is a very carefully done thing, and just yet another reason the guy won a Nobel Prize. It's very high right now, and the only higher time actually was in 2000. It was about 45%, the ratio, 45. The ratio was about 45, it's 34 now. 34 is higher than 95% of the readings that have ever occurred in the stock market since 1881. And there's only been one peak higher, and that was the so-called internet bubble, whatever you want to call it, that occurred in 2000. So the market looks pretty pricey to me. And Shiller now thinks there's a 50% chance of a recession. I think it's a little higher than that. He, by the way, Shiller is not a monetarist. Shiller is a Keynesian. So that's the stock market. That's basically in a nutshell, to summarize. I'm a little bit with Jamie Dimon and Warren Buffett. They haven't been injected with irrational exuberance. Neither is Hanke.
So is this the calm before the storm?
Yeah, this is the exuberance before the storm. I mean, everybody's in the party, everybody's celebrating and wildly optimistic. And especially if you listen to some of the Silicon Valley crowd, they say artificial intelligence is going to save man, and change the world and everything. Well, it will change a lot of things, by the way. But when you put it into context, they say things like this. And this is how you can kind of take them to school a little bit. They say, oh, artificial intelligence, that's going to change everything. Our productivity will zoom in the United States. And instead of, they say, we'll have real economic growth of 6% per year. Well, now 6% per year, that's three times higher than the current potential growth rate in the United States. We haven't seen that kind of jump ever in history. So, black swans are possible, but they're not very likely.
So let's talk about the inflation rate. And I know you said that with this contraction in the money supply, we're going to get a big pullback in the inflation rate. You think it's going to be approaching 2% or lower by the end of the year. But we just recently had a very strong CPI number. We had very strong retail numbers. And we had your good friend Powell speak recently. He also said it almost sounded like rates are going to be higher for longer. And I think the dot plot in March, they said they were expecting three rate cuts with the first one coming in June. It sounds like it's going to be beyond that now. What do you think about what's happening right now in the economy? And then, of course, I got to touch on what's happening in the Middle East with oil prices and with the potential for oil prices to go significantly higher. How does this all fit into your scenario?
Well, first of all, the inflation rate was coming down fast from that peak of 9.1. And then the first quarter, the last 3 months, it's kind of plateaued at more or less where we are now, 3.5. So it was coming down, and then it plateaued. It's going to start going down again. And John Greenwood and I, again, originally thought, without this plateau in the picture, this little kink in the trend, we thought it would be down to 2% or below by the end of the year. That will occur, but it might not occur quite by the end of the year. It might take it a little bit longer, but it will come down to the target. Now, about Powell and policy, they don't look at the money supply. They've canceled the money supply, and they're data dependent. They're looking at current data, and that's it. So he looks at the current 3 months of the CPI. He says, "Oh, we better stay higher for longer, tighter for longer." Now, I think that's inappropriate. They've been way too tight and for way too long, and If anything, you ask about, well, how deep do I think the recession is going to be? I think if they stay tighter for longer, that will simply mean that the recession will be drug out for longer and might even be a little deeper than we are more or less anticipating. So that's that side of the picture. The Fed has just got us on this. They're just all wrong. They're not looking at the money supply. They're looking at current data. And as a result of that, they're just whipsawing us. We're on a roller coaster. I said, unprecedented increase in the money supply. February 2021, it peaked at 27% year over year. Highest it's ever been in the history of the Fed. And now, boom, we're coming down and we're contracting. We've only had four contractions in the history of the Fed. And as you say, you've got to go back to 1948, 49 to even pick up the last one we had before. So they're on a roller coaster. They just are not with it. They don't follow the Hanke's golden growth rate, about 6% per year constant rate, and you're going to come pretty close to hitting the inflation target. And that's what they were doing, by the way, with Greenspan in the 1990s. That wasn't that long ago. Why did we have a pretty constant inflation rate in the United States and pretty good growth and sustainability, a long boom? It was because the money supply was growing more or less at a constant rate of around 6% per annum. So that's the money supply part of it. What's going on with the wars in Ukraine and the Middle East? That's another kettle of fish. Creating a lot of uncertainty. However, it's interesting since the last weekend when the Iranians following the bombing and assassination in the consulate in Syria by Israel, and then of course the Iranians responded as they said they would and gave everybody a fair warning that they were going to respond. They did, and the markets really didn't do much of anything. I mean, even the gold market was. I measure the sentiment in the gold market every on an hourly basis, and the sentiment in the gold market really it hardly changed at all.
No, that's a fair point. And the price of oil didn't really respond either.
The price of oil didn't really respond either initially, although today, as we speak, you know, it's the 17th of April, and the oil price did take a little bit of a tumble today. Let me just see what we're doing now. Yeah, it's down about $2.50 a barrel. It's running around West Texas. It's running around $83 a barrel. And I'm just looking. In the last month, it's been between about 86 and 88, something like that, more or less chopping around up at the top. And that now it's taken a little dive down. It's now we're down at 82, 85. So let's say we were about 85, more or less, for the last couple of weeks. And now all of a sudden it's peeled off some and we're down around 83.
Steve, the Fed lost a lot of credibility in 2021 when they said inflation was transitory. And then they kind of woke up to reality in March of 2022 when they started lifting interest rates, and they did so at a very accelerated pace. But as we stand right now, do you think the Fed is making another policy error by keeping rates too high for too long?
Oh yeah, there's no question about it. They're not paying. Monetary policy is not about interest rates. It's about changes in the money supply. Point number one. And all they're doing is fooling around, keeping their eye on interest rates, keeping their eye on current data that are coming out about the economy and so forth. And not even paying attention to the money supply. I mean, they've explicitly said, Powell has testified to this over and over again, that there's really all these linkages I'm giving you between the money supply and saying the money supply is the fuel in the economy and the thing that drives everything, which any youngster would tell you that, you know. I mean, If they gave your children a lot more money, what would the child say? Well, they'd say, you know, I'm in heaven. I'm going to be buying a lot more candy and other things, you know. And then if you ask them, well, is that going to make the shop owner happy? Going to make things good? He might even hire more people. They'd say, oh, maybe he would. So everyone gets a connection. Anyone with any sense has any connection. But the Fed clearly has no sense, and they have this ill-conceived idea about these financial conditions, indices, and, you know, you name it, credit spreads, interest rates, employment levels, jolt reports, all these things coming in. Every day they're looking at all of this stuff and trying to make sense out of it, not stupidly not realizing that what causes these things to move around is what happened to the money supply a year and a half ago, or maybe 2 years ago, maybe even 3 years ago.
Well, how do you explain that? Like, they must have many economists working within the Fed. They have some very smart people there examining all of this data.
They have a lot of economists in the Fed system. They have about 785 professional economists, and none of them were able to forecast the inflation that we had. None. None of them got it. Well, Greenwood and I did get it. We were using the quantity theory of money, and they weren't using the quantity theory of money. Now, why weren't they using it? Because most of them have been trained in a contemporary university setting, where post-Keynesian models are the order of the day for the last 30 years, and post-Keynesian models don't include a variable for a monetary aggregate. Money is not in the model. So the theoretical tools they have and apparatus are rubbish, basically. That's point number one. And point number two, there is a political aspect to the thing, because out of the 785 economists who work at the Fed, 48.5 of those are in the Democratic, the ratio, 48.5 to 1, almost 50 economists versus one are in the Democratic Party. You got 50 Democrats for every one Republican. Now you say, well, what's that have to do with anything? And it has a lot to do with something, because Who was the dean of monetarism and the quantity theory of money in the 20th century? Nobel laureate Milton Friedman. And Friedman was a heavy advisor to all the Republicans. He clearly was in the Republican Party. So and in particular, influenced a great deal Ronald Reagan and the bringing down of the inflation we had in the late 1970s was Paul Volcker, and Volcker embraced the quantity theory of money. In other words, Volcker said, well, to get in, Reagan says, I want to get inflation down. And I think that means we got to get the quantity of money slowing down. And Volcker says, yeah, I agree with you. And that's what I'm going to do. And that's what he did. So the kind of target, plus Friedman had a lot of other, should we say, policy prescriptions besides just the monetarism that rubbed the Democrats the wrong way. In other words, Friedman was not a state interventionist, he like most Democrats are. Most Democrats want to go to the government to get something fixed. If they see a problem, you go to the government and try to get it fixed. Well, Friedman was just the opposite. If you see a problem, you want to go to the private sector to get it fixed, not the government. So I think that is another factor in this picture. I think there is a technical bias of particularly young economists that are not trained properly in macroeconomics, and that's why they never can get anything right. They're always wrong, by the way. So that's one thing. And the second thing is, I think there also is really a political bias. Friedman was a quantity theory of money man, and that's just another reason why we at the Fed don't want to be using that model. We want to be using the models we were trained with, the post-Keynesian models that don't have money. They don't have Milton Friedman in there. Friedman is passé.
So if you were going to give the Fed a grade, what grade would you give them?
F.
Wow.
Oh, this is one of the worst performers.
You're a tough marker.
I would say I'm a fair marker. I'm a little bit old school. I'm not into the great inflation thing. It never really grabbed me very much. I think you should have standards, and you should evaluate policies and people's performance based on, you know, old school standards. I don't like to shrink the hurdle. The hurdle is up here, and if you go over it, you get a pat on the back and a good grade. If you crash through the thing, you're going to get an F. And by the way, when I say this, the only time really the Fed is screwed this thing up worse than the current time is 1929, 1933. I mean, if you go back to those periods that I gave you, that's the only real one that stands out as being, you know, completely catastrophic. And that Great Depression was at the hands of the Fed. And complementing that, of course, we had the politicians in Washington doing, Congress was doing its thing with the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, and that's the direction we're going in now. A lot of protectionism. So the stew is you know, it is a perfect cocktail that's being stirred up. We've got the incompetent Fed, that's the monetary side, and the general policy side, there's a lot of protectionist talk and action in the wind. You can't pick up the paper without seeing something about attacking China, for example. Secretary Yellen was just in China, and she said that, well, they're suffering from overcapacity. Now, what in the world's overcapacity? She said, don't send us this excess that you're producing. So does that mean that's strictly a protectionist ruse that she's put forward? She's basically saying that let's stop international trade if you have capacity to produce more than you can consume at home, you're a bad guy and you should stop that. And we should try to stop it with protectionist measures. Either you voluntarily don't stop exporting, or we'll put a quota on you, or we'll put tariffs on you to slow you down. It was an incredible and stupid statement in my view, but very dangerous. Like the Smoot-Hawley tariff, that was another reason we plunged into the Great Depression. Money was the big thing that dominated, but the tariff was bad.
Well, that was a fascinating discussion, Steve. And if someone would like to learn more about you and hear more of your thoughts, where can they go?
I think the easiest thing is to go to my Twitter. It's just @Steve_Hanke. Right now, I have 727,000 followers. That's the third highest of any economist in the world. And I'm putting out things, you know, on a regular basis every day. If you want to join my distribution list and have me send you articles that I write and things like that, you just send me an email at Hanke, Hanke, @jhu.edu. That's my university email.
Well, once again, that was a great discussion. Thank you very much for making the time.
You're welcome, James. Great to be with you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Steve Hanke. One of the reasons we do these interviews with people like Steve is to give you some sort of insight as to what's happening within the global economy and also how to prepare for it. And if you're trying to prepare for your financial future, consider having a discussion with a Wealthion-endorsed financial advisor at Wealthion.com. There's no obligation to work with any of these advisors. It's a free service that Wealthion offers to all of its viewers. Don't forget to subscribe to our channel, Wealthion.com, and also hit that notification button to be kept up to date on upcoming events. Once again, thank you for spending time with us today, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.